Remember how, like, the late or mid to late 80s, he did Brazil and Baron Munchausen and stuff like that? It almost has that kind of storytelling feel to it.
Oh, yeah. And that's one of the things, actually, when we write lyrics, a lot of times, you know, before we even, you know, sit down to start doing a song, we try and kind of come up with a concept of, you know, what are we trying to portray, and what kind of scene are we trying to paint for the listener? And really just how that, you know, kind of the whole point of Another Life specifically was just to, you know, kind of be able to listen to the music and kind of be transported to another place and kind of think like, you know, where am I at? And, you know, what is this, you know, alternative life, or, you know, so to be. And I think, yeah, just that whole storytelling aspect of the music kind of has been lost in many ways, just because every artist is trying to be kind of cater to their audience and be like, oh, I'm going to make my lyrics really broad. I'm going to make sure that everyone can relate to it, which we do that in a sense, but all at the same time, there's that specific story going on underneath.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's a thin line between broad and bland, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, there's I've seen a lot of artists today go from broad to so broad that they've diluted their content.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. Yeah, and I mean, part of me, you know, everyone loves, you know, lyrics that everyone can relate to. But at the same time, if it's so open to interpretation, you don't really know what the song is trying to tell you or what you're trying to get out of the song, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Well, let me go ahead and start the interview right now.
Definitely.
So Christian, how did Renaissance Kids get its start?
Well, actually, we... So in the band, it's just me and Nico, and we both were actually in a band prior to this together, and I was a drummer, and he was a bassist, and we've been in the band, you know, this band, I don't really want to mention the name, but we've been in the band for about 2 years, I want to say, and we worked it up to the point where I think there were about four of us in the band, and we had a couple different record deals on the table, and we're all kind of, you know, going through our heads, like, what are we going to do? Who should we sign with? What should we do? Should we stay independent? And pretty much as soon as all those deals kind of came on the table, the vocalist just got really egotistical, and that kind of broke the band up.
Suffered from LSD, did he? Lead singer disease?
yeah, exactly. So, yeah, that took a toll on our body, as you can imagine. So pretty much, you know, on top of it, though, the worst part is that they were very egotistical and they didn't have the skills to back it up. You know, they weren't, you know, if you're a front man of a band, your job, you know, not only is to do the vocals, but you're there to entertain. And if you can't entertain a crowd, then you just don't have any place, you know, being up on that stage as a front man. And that, you know, they just couldn't, you know, bottom line, could not entertain a crowd. You know, they just stand up there and walk back and forth. And it's like, if you don't feel your own music, then like, how is anyone else going to feel it?
Yeah. It's almost like they're just doing a presentation.
Yeah, exactly. And by the end of it, you know, we spent, gosh, about 6 months writing six songs, which, you know, by the end of this process, I think Nico and I were just so fed up with taking so long, you know, having deals on the table and having people being, you know, getting, I guess, fluffed almost because of those deals are on the table and gaining that ego. So we eventually got to the point where, you know, we were just done with the negative vibes, and we're like, you know, we could either A, try and stick it out and, you know, maybe sign with a label and still deal with all this bull crap, or we can start, you know, completely fresh and, you know, do something new. And that's pretty much how Renaissance Kids came about. You know, one day I just called Nico and I was like, hey man, I think I'm done with the band. I think I'm going to, you know, start my own thing. And, I pretty much told him like, we're going to go balls deep. You know, this is, you know, we're not going to hold back. And really the project is, you know, when we were in this other band, it was all about the business aspect and just, you know, the fun kind of got left behind. And with this project, we wanted to, you know, keep business in mind, obviously, because music is a business, but all at the same time, you know, the big thing for us is just that we enjoy what we're doing and enjoy the music that we're playing.
Exactly. Now, one thing that should be brought to the spotlight on this is, especially after hearing Another Life, which is your EP that comes out exactly 1 week from today, so November 24th, is that you guys have only, you know, Renaissance Kids has only been around since July.
Yep. That is true.
That begs me to ask the question, the quality of Another Life, you know, because I've already heard it. It's hard to believe that the band is only 4 months old, you know, not to mention that the songs were already written and recorded between then and now.
Right. Yeah, I can totally get on board with that. It is, it's been a crazy experience. You know, one of the things that I think what kind of prompted us to work so fast and try and get everything done so quickly was, you know, spending 6 months writing six songs was just kind of that motivation. Like, I'm not going to let that happen again. There's just no way. So, you know, the first thing we did was, you know, as soon as I talked to him about it, I immediately started hitting up some producers that I like and, you know, somebody that I wanted to record with. And Cameron Mizell just seemed like the perfect fit. He's a great guy too. And, you know, all throughout the time we were in the studio, it was great because we were just laughing the whole time, which is, you know, just so much fun when you're working on music and all at the same time, you're just joking about whatever else it may be while you're getting it done.
Exactly. Well, and another thing is too, is I don't think a lot of people realize this, but the fun or lack of fun that you have when making an EP or an album or even a song is you can hear it in the final product.
Oh yeah. It's reflected in whether you want it to be or not, it's reflected in the music just because, you know, you can't just turn that off. Like if there's negative vibes, you feel it and your mind kind of just pushes that out.
Yeah. Now I have to ask, is the reason that you and Nico delved into the studio so fast and cranked these out, is that the reason you guys were a duo? Is because you didn't have time to look for other players?
It's part of the reason. That's one of those things that it's always hard trying to find new members for a band. So, you know, obviously there's so many things that just have to fall into place with personalities and work ethic and so on. And one thing that I really liked about Nico is that Nico, he doesn't like to deal with confrontation, but all at the same time, he's upfront with you. And for me, like in every band that I've been in, I have been doing, you know, all the work. So like, you know, I told him like, if you just worry about doing musical stuff, and I'll just worry about, you know, all the logistics and, you know, getting things out there and making sure things happen, then we'll be fine. And the biggest thing, though, is that I really like the idea of a duo, especially in a genre where you've got, you know, most bands are between four and six people. So to me, it's just kind of refreshing to see two people playing, you know, some heavy stuff and, you know, not necessarily needing that whole band to fill in all the space and, you know, maybe a show not putting the synths in there just because you think, you know, on a song you want it to be raw or, you know, I think the biggest thing was just I didn't want to look for people. And the idea of a duo is just very attractive to me. I've always been, you know, for less is more, you know. You don't always need, you know, six guys in a band chugging away. You know, sometimes two people or three people all up on stage, you know, doing what they're supposed to be doing and really feeling it can just, you know, drive that show even farther than, you know, six guys jumping up and down.
Well, and also too, see, I'm a guitarist myself and I've been in situations where I've answered ads or whatnot to be in a band and the band has no material and they're trying to explain it to me what they want, what the vision they have, and it's going right over my head. Whereas with what you guys have done, if you were to choose to add more people, you can give them the album and then say, this is who we are.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, we've been kind of toying around with the idea of adding another person just because there's a bass player we really like who, his name's Jelani. But so we haven't, you know, come to a conclusion on this, but we're actually going to be also doing a live in studio video here in want to say about a month or so. And he'll be filling in for the bass on that because obviously two people can't play guitar, drums, keys, and bass all at the same time. So we end up backtracking just one or two things. And luckily, you know, when it's just going to be the three of us, just in that live and studio environment, all we'll have to backtrack, if anything, would be just like keys and synths and stuff, which I've always been a fan of, you know, shows that are completely raw, that every sound that you're hearing is coming right from that amp. And, you know, the idea of backtracks have become, you know, in modern society, like people accept them. But I always, whenever I hear it, I'm just like, should really have someone up there doing that, or even, you know, give the drummer a MIDI pad to you know, hit one note and start the whole chain of notes or whatever it may be.
Mm-hmm. Cause that was actually going to be my next question. With the two of you, how are you, you know, how, cause this music is fairly complex, you know, and obviously more than two instruments. So how, you know, how would you plan on doing a tour? Because I mean, I was thinking, you know, maybe you would do something like, I don't know, like what the Doors did. They didn't have a bass player live, but Ray Manzarek took over the bass with the low end of the keys, you know, or something like that.
Right. Well, I guess one of the, you know, it might make a little bit more sense once the music video comes out, but obviously, yeah, we can't play, you know, two instruments or three instruments at the same time if we're singing, drumming, and whatever. I mean, I sing, scream, and drum at the same time. So I have a lot of duties to cover. And when it comes to, this has been kind of a big point of, not necessarily contention, but just something that we've kind of talked over and haven't really come to a conclusion, is that there are a lot of different ways that we can perform the music live. You know, we can break it down to being just him and I, to where we're, you know, maybe backtracking just the bass guitar. And I've got a MIDI pad where I'm every so often hitting it where it starts, you know, the chain of synth and the chain of the keys. And basically just be him and I with a bass backtracked, him singing and playing guitar and doing some screams, and then me singing, drumming, and screaming all at the same time. That being said, you know, doing something like that, kind of, you're held back on an entertainment standpoint because you can't move around, you know, especially as a drummer and a drummer singer, when you're behind the set, there's not much you can do to entertain people other than, you know, rock your head back and forth, or even, you know, as a guitar player, you know, you're locked behind your instrument and you can't move around freely. So, you know, we're kind of either between playing as two people, just him and I, or, you know, getting a backup drummer, you know, to cover the drums, so at least one of us can be, you know, off of their instrument, you know, getting the crowd going and getting everybody moving.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd go the Phil Collins route, basically.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, well, I mean, here, think about this, like, would you consider yourself a drummer first then, or a singer first?
Definitely a drummer first. I've been playing drums for, gosh, it's probably been about 12 years now. And like, I'm a very rhythm-oriented person, but I mean, I play guitar, I play bass, you know, I play some keys here and there, and both Nico and I actually play a little bit of everything, but singing is actually something that I picked up in the past few years, and I never really considered myself a singer. You know, I always sing in the car and do all that fun stuff, but when it came down to it at the end of the day, you know, when I'd be in bands, I'd be like, yeah, you're the singer because, you know, X, Y, Z, and I'm not the singer because of X, Y, Z. And that actually, you know, that whole idea kind of flipped after I dealt with a lot of terrible singers who, I don't know, people that don't take their instruments seriously. And, you know, they think like, oh yeah, you know, I'd love to be on, you know, in the spotlight, in the front. People will hear my beautiful voice, but they don't put the time into doing the scales and, you know, learning their inner hearing and all that. So after dealing with so many people like that, I really started pushing myself to kind of, you know, bring vocals up to kind of the level that I drum at in, you know, a tenth of the time or so.
Well, is it hard singing and playing drums at the same time? Because I've known drummers that do that, and a lot of them have said, man, after a 2-hour show, they get pretty winded.
Mm-hmm. So for me, singing and drumming is, I mean, compared to just drumming is obviously harder. Singing and drumming compared to screaming and drumming is significantly easier. the screaming and drumming has been something that's been really different for me, because I've sang and drummed before and done that for, a bunch of different bands, or, played a cover song here and there where I sing and drum and we're filling in for somebody. But screaming and drumming is something that's, a little bit more rare in pretty much any genre of music, I'd say. So learning how to do that has been actually quite the process. I've put in probably hundreds of hours, playing the same songs, just trying to get through the syncopations. And, you've got the complex drum syncopation, with the guitar and the bass, but then you've got this vocal syncopation going over the top of it that is essentially completely different. And trying to differentiate that in, a drummer's head is pretty hard. But I have a big background in, playing like polyrhythms and doing all that weird jazz stuff. So kind of being able to do, what happens to me is that I stop thinking about playing the drums. I play the part, I know them 100%, and my body basically just does it, while all I'm focusing on is just doing the vocals.
Yeah, exactly. And I know exactly what you're talking about, because as a guitarist myself, I've always been in one guitar bands. I don't know why, it just always ends up that way. And past singing, backup, if you were to try to make me be the lead singer on top of the lead guitarist, I couldn't do it. It's like too complicated. I have to really think about one or the other. And so I know exactly what you're talking about. And I actually think for drummers that would be worse, because I could stand still and play the guitar and sing, whereas like you, you're surrounded by your instrument. I'm holding mine.
Yeah, right. No, I can totally get that. And playing, I feel like playing lead guitar and doing vocals, they're obviously two different things, but I feel like it might actually be harder than playing the drums and doing lead vocals, because at least with the drums, I'm able to, for instance, with my right hand, I can instantly stop thinking about it, because all it's going to be doing is 1, 2, 3, 4, or 1, 2, 3, 4. And then my left hand, I know it's going to always be on the 2 and 4, so I can basically turn that off, and I can slowly, go through elements of my drumming where I can be like, I don't have to think about this, I don't have to think about this. It opens up my mind to think about other things. Whereas with lead guitar, I feel like, you're going up and down on the spectrum, and it's not like you're playing a repeated beat, 4 times or something. You've got variation and so on and so forth, to the point where it's like, you have to think about it,
Exactly. And I'm one of those guys too that has to take a peek at the fretboard once in a while. I'm gonna totally screw up, especially live. And what you're talking about actually makes sense, because with drumming, you could use the rhythm that you're creating to keep the beat on your voice.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And especially you can start. Kind of like, you can go back and forth with it, where it's like, maybe you're thinking about your right hand where you're doing the 1, 2, 3, 4, because it keeps your vocals in time. And then, you're turning off the rest of your body essentially. And that's something I really picked up on when I started, learning polyrhythms to begin with, playing 2 different time signatures or 3 different time signatures at the same time. Because at that point, it's not even like you're playing a repeated pattern, or it doesn't feel like it. Your pattern repeats every 7 measures or something. And after doing that, it really kind of just opened up my mind to being able to not necessarily multitask, but not think about doing one thing while focusing on the other. So.
Exactly. Okay, now being a musician myself, I gotta ask the total geek out musician question that I ask everybody, because this is the stuff, you know this yourself, this is the stuff musicians talk about when they're alone in rooms together. Okay, what's your gear?
Right now, so I guess, for the past 3 or 4 years, I've been lucky enough to buy and sell endless amounts of drum sets, and I've been lucky enough to be able to play just about any drum set you can name, other than, some $10,000 off brand I've never heard of. But right now I play a DW Collector Series. So I have a 3-piece in just the normal maple. They're not like any of the vertical low timber shells or anything like that. And then I use a DW 14 by 6.5 metal or steel snare that's 1 millimeter in thickness. And that's by far one of my favorite snares I've ever used, especially for, you know, it's just kind of ironic using a metal snare to play metal music, but it works perfectly.
I bet you it's got some bite to it. Cause I mean, I've heard metal snares before. Oh, yeah. They just cut through everything.
And the thing I like about this one is that it's got a lower pitch to it. So it's not like one of those really, like, I can't stand snares that ring for days. I mean, for certain music, it makes sense, but for metal, it's just the most cacophonous thing to your ears.
I think for metal, and you almost need like the marching band snare sound.
Yep, exactly. And, you know, it's kind of funny that you say that because, when I was first learning the drums, that's how I started, was initially with marching snare drum. I think that kind of crafted my ideal snare sound for the rest of my life. But yeah, I play DW Collectors. I guess technically I only play 4 drums, and I play a small kick drum, which I love. It's a 20-inch in diameter and 16 inches in depth. And the thing I like about it so much is that it's so, compared to like an 18x22, you know, that's pretty much the size that everyone uses, is that it doesn't have that deepness to it. It's not, I don't lose definition when I'm playing da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da on the double bass.
Yeah. You're talking like that deep Lars Ulrich, Tommy Lee sound.
Right, yeah. But just that, like, I don't know, when you hear a typical bass drum, it's got that boom to it. You know, it's got the low end to it that I guess my drum doesn't necessarily have. It's a lot more of a mid-rangey drum where you still have the low end, but you don't have any of those super, like, sub-frequencies that are going to sit around for days and kind of mess up your live mix or whatever. But DW has been, I guess, for the past couple years, my all-time favorite set to play. You know, I don't think I could play anything else after playing a DW. And even their, you know, their lower-end PDP kits are reminiscent of their, you know, high-end DW Collector series, which I just think is fantastic for a company to kind of throughout all their drum lines instill the same quality control across the board.
Exactly. And I've heard a lot of good things about DW. You know what's funny? I know a lot of drummers that play Pearl, Tama, Ludwig, whatever, and then the hardware's DW.
Yep.
you ever notice
I've seen it all over the place. And I feel like it's because DW, their nicer stands they're huge. I mean, they're not huge, but they're just so well built, you know, like you could buy one of those stands and have it for 15 years, throw it off a cliff, go down there, grab it and be fine. But, yeah, DW, they've just done a great job. You know, I used to play a Pearl reference. I've played a number of the custom companies, which, you know, all use the same shells anyways. And the only other company that I think kind of, you know, has their drums online or, you know, on par with DW would actually be Pork Pie. I forget the owner's name, but they're, you know, I'm not too big on a lot of their snare drums just because they're very ringy, but their toms and their kicks are just completely different from any other custom company because all the custom drum companies actually use the same shells. They're all Keller shells and you're starting with the same thing, but the way you end with it, you know, how much time and just precision you take crafting and doing the bearing edges and all that just makes a world of difference. And those guys, they definitely take their time and it shows when you hear the drums and it's just amazing how, I don't know, like when I initially started getting into music, you're like, oh, you know, what's the difference between a $400 set and a $4,000 set? And quickly you find out that it's not just the, you know, the wood or the materials, but it's really how much time someone's putting into, you know, checking that drum and being like, oh, that is a perfectly an F sharp note when I tune it right. But on top of DW, actually, I play Meinl cymbals, which is something that I've been really new to.
Those are those handmade actually in Germany cymbals, aren't they?
Yep. And a lot of my favorite drummers use them. Gosh, I don't know why this guy is evading my mind right now. I'll have to get back to it. But just, yeah, a lot of drummers I really enjoy. You know, I listen to a lot of different, you know, like jazz drums, and I really love gospel drummers. It's kind of funny because, you know, I play metal, but a lot of my roots are in, different music as far as the drums specifically. But I really got into Meinl because, you know, I started seeing all these people using them. I'm like, well, there's got to be a reason why people like this. You know, before this point, I'd been playing all Zildjian A and K customs. I'd messed around with all, you know, the Sabian AAX and all those different lines. And I always loved Zildjian. And there's, you know, there's something that for the longest time I was like, you cannot beat this cymbal. This cymbal is, every time I play it, is the best thing ever. And that was kind of the case with pretty much every Zildjian I picked up. But when I heard Meinl for the first time, my first words were, these sound like shit. I could not believe how bad they sounded to me. And I played them without any music. You know, I was just no headphones, just sitting behind the set, and I started playing them. And then the first time that I played those cymbals with, you know, music in my headphones, I was just taken over. I could not believe how much of a difference it made and just how all the nuances and you know, the cymbals that they make just provide a basis in the mix that just, it's beautiful. I couldn't believe that how much of a difference it made just from listening without the music to listening with the music, and just being in the mix really makes a difference. And I actually, I use some cymbals that are technically, I guess, not released right now by Meinl, not on their, you know, their main brand or whatever. They do like a couple different like limited edition cymbals and like short run cymbals, just to kind of see how they, you know, fare in the market and whether or not people, you know, would possibly buy a large quantity of them or whatever. And this cymbal has actually become, you know, my all-time favorite in the past year or so. The Meinl 18-inch Brilliant Trash Crash.
Oh, and that just sounds nice, man.
Right, just hearing it, you just like, oof. And the thing I love about this cymbal is, well, A, you know, pretty much no one else has it. So just that exclusivity thing just makes me feel special. But also, it's got that fine line between being too bright and too trashy. It's got small, you know, you've probably seen those cymbals with the big holes in them to kind of give them that trashy effect. This one's got, you know, if you could think of like how big those holes are, these holes are probably about 30% the size of those. So they do them smaller, and because of that, it actually gives the cymbal, you know, that trashy quality, but it still keeps a lot of the brightness in it. So it's not like super brash, and it's not going to be specific to like a metal song. I can play it in, you know, hip hop even, and it'll sound great. And so another thing is that Meinl cymbals is, you know, the more I play them, the more I'm able to hear, you know, how well they fit in different mixes, and just how, you know, one cymbal for me could fit into pretty much every single genre except for maybe one or two.
Mm-hmm. And their cymbals, you know what I always thought was crazy about their cymbals, because I've played with drummers that have used them, and you can see the hammer marks in them.
Oh yeah. You can tell that, you know, there's a few companies that, I think mine only does it for a couple of their cymbals where they, you know, they'll have a machine hammer it rather than a person, but there's only a few companies that still have someone hand hammer their cymbals. And I know for at least, you know, a majority of the Meinl lines, that's how it is that you can see, like, I recently had to buy two of the exact same cymbal because for music videos, which this was unfortunate because obviously cymbals are expensive, but for music videos, which I never knew, you know, I've seen people tape their cymbals to kind of reduce the sound and so on, but they actually, you double stack your cymbals so that they don't make any noise. And, you know, they look the exact same because obviously you have two of the exact same cymbals stacked on top of each other. But when I bought, I play a 20-inch Meinl traditional Byzance ride, and I have one that's, it's probably from, I want to say like the 90s that I bought used, you know, a few years back. And it's a really old one that, you know, from back in the day, it doesn't even have the same marks on it, but technically it's the same exact symbol as the one that I just bought. And just looking at the two, you can see exactly that, like the variation in the hammering marks and how, like, one of mine, it almost looks like a kind of like a chip almost in the symbol, which I don't know how else to explain it, but you know, whereas in the other one, it doesn't have anything like that. And just like how, you know, two different people doing the same thing on a cymbal can create completely different aesthetics. And as well as like when I play those two cymbals back to back, they're not, I mean, they're obviously, they have similarities, but they're not at all the same.
Yeah. It's almost like fingerprints.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
I know. Well, I mean, yeah. Cause I mean, it, like Meinl, some of their higher gear, or the higher price gear, is hand hammered. So I mean, like, it's almost like samurai sword making. mean, like nothing.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, no two are going to be alike. You know, they're great cymbals. Like I said, I've known drummers that have used them. I had one drummer that had one that actually looked like total crap. I used to ask him if he was ever going to take some Brasso cleaner to it or something, because he was like no, they come from the factory like that. They actually have like that aged copper look to it.
Oh yeah, the ones that are, they're not laid or anything, it's just that raw metal. And I love the look of those. And actually the hi-hats I play are these, they just recently started I guess releasing these to the public. And you know, I think almost every single Meinl artist you can think of, you know, saw Meinl release these and were, you know, sent them a message like, hey, you got to send me some of these cymbals. And they're the 15-inch dual hi-hats, which basically, like, the outer edge of the hi-hat is that laid, like, nice, glossy finish. And then the inner portions of it are completely unlaid, so it's that, you know, that dark, earthy-looking tone. And I've been able to get so many different sounds out of one hi-hat that it is just, it is beyond me. Like because of how they've made it, there are three distinct areas where I'm able to hit the hi-hat to create different amounts of, you know, essentially the same hit of, you know, different percussiveness, and having, you know, it's almost like having three hi-hats in one that I just couldn't believe it.
yeah, exactly. And they're actually, from what I hear, they're worth every penny. I mean, that same drummer I was telling you about, he told me, like, because he's got a full set of those around his mm-hmm. kit, and he's got a DW as well. His is the one with the subwoofer on the bass and stuff. And,
oh yeah.
And he told me flat out, he's like, the cymbals cost more than the freaking kit. he's like, that's the first thing he said. He was like, yeah, the cymbals cost more than the kit.
So that is like, I think I have, you know, kind of the same story, especially because I play such a small kit. You know, if I have, I try to keep, I'm more of a minimalist when it comes to my setup. I prefer, you know, give me a bass, snare, and a hi-hat and I'll be happy. but when I've got, you know, my whole like five or six cymbals set up, you know, my set, I guess, you know, I bought it used because I knew I was going to be taking it all over the place. And I was like, ah, it's going to get trashed. Just going to have to suck it up and get a used one. And on top of it, I feel like buying a brand new drum set is kind of an error for anyone to do. Because, like, if, you know, the first time you move it, you can bet yourself $100 that you're going to run it into some door and something's going to get scratched up.
Yep. Well, I mean, that's true with anything. Like, I mean, the guitars I used to tour with, man, all look like shit. They've been dropped down stairwells, and they've been knocked over. They got cigarette burns on them from back in the day.
All the good stuff.
Yeah, all the plastic on the pit guards has that yellow tinge to it from all the bars, and you know, mm-hmm. I mean, they're just gonna look like shit. I mean, to go in and buy like a custom shop and then play it live is a crime.
that's exactly how I feel. Like, you walking in there with $10,000 of drum gear to play for your, what could be 30 minutes or it could be a couple hours for, you know, maybe $100-$200 is just not, it doesn't add up. Like, you're risking so much for so little. Other than, you know, I won't lie, I like looking cool on stage. I like having my nice set.
Exactly. You know what I find ironic too, like with guitars nowadays, Fender and a few others in their custom shop actually double the price on guitars that they make look like had the shit beat out of them. You know, with the paint wore out and everything, and the, you know, the fret
blur. That's beyond me.
Yeah, I was
it's almost like they're charging you, like, hey, we're going to charge you, so we're going to paint it. We're going to, you know, make it look perfect.
Yeah, but exactly.
You're paying us to make it look like shit real quick.
Yeah.
You're going to make it look like it's been through 15 years of wear.
Yeah. I mean, I got a couple strats that were aged like that naturally over 20 years, man. I mean, like,
you know, that reminds me of, have you seen A Day to Remember's drummer's drum kit, or at least maybe his old one?
No.
It almost looks like a drum kit full. It's like they look like acorns, almost like giant acorns. Like, you know, it's not like a normal drum where it's, you know, circular, like, you know, cylindrical. It's, you've got, you know, the circular for the head, and then it comes down and kind of makes like a cone almost.
I think I know what you're talking about.
This kit, I swear, it looks like someone just, you know, basically took a shit all over it. Like, it looks kind of interesting, but it's like kind of one of those things where, you know, you buy a $5,000 set, and, you know, right out of the package, it's kind of meant to look like, you know, like it's been beaten up and like it's, you know, worn down.
Yeah, exactly. Well, there's a guy, well, actually his name is Mark Bennett. He's the drum tech for Korn, for Ray Luzier. If you go on YouTube, on his YouTube channel, he's endorsing a guy, I forget the guy's name, but he makes complete drum kits out of wine barrels.
Oh, I think I saw that, yeah. Actually.
And they actually sound kick-ass.
I've seen another company, I think, too, that they just go around and they salvage wood, and they make drum sets out of that. And some of those sets, actually, it's surprising how good they sound, because there's, you know, again, like, no two drums are going to be anywhere near the same, even if you put, you know, all the same elements into it.
Exactly. But, I mean, these are like the wine barrel kits. They're like the real old school. There were real wine barrels. Some of them, he says, are over 100 years old. They're the ones that have the iron band around it. And, you know, it's all the planks put together. And then, you know, he puts like Evans or Remo heads on it, you know, because the barrels, by some weird coincidence, you know, are the same diameter as a lot of the drum skins that are out there.
That's crazy.
So, yeah.
That would be a blast, though. I could just imagine being like, I'm going to go and find some wine barrels to make a drum set right now.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah, you should YouTube it. I mean, the ones that I've heard
sound fun. That's a really cool concept.
Yeah, I mean, and I see one where the kick drum is like actually a good three or 4 feet long, you know, because it's the actual, you know, keg.
Mm-hmm.
So, wow. and it's
I'll have to check that out. That's really cool.
Yeah, and they just sound like phenomenal. It's a, you know, it's got that deep bass punch, but it's not muddled. It's clear and everything. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, it's great. But, well, let's talk about another life for a bit. Like we talked about earlier, the songs are just brilliant. I mean, I didn't know you guys were two guys when I heard it. I thought it was a four or five piece, you know?
Yeah.
So, cause I mean, they're just that thought out. And I mean, when I say that, I'm not talking about four or five people that got into a studio and recorded this. I'm talking about the minds of four or five musicians. That's what it sounds like. You know, I mean, the music, like I said, is textured, layered, and intricate. The hooks are there, the drops are there, everything. But also the lyrics are just gorgeous. I mean, they're lush. They have, you know, an artistic feel to them that, you know, it's almost like a painting.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. And, you know, kind of what's interesting is that, you know, musically, we, you know, I guess we're lucky enough to be a couple of multi-instrumentalists who can think, you know, from a couple different perspectives, but then, you know, you bring a producer on board and you've got these three different perspectives from three different multi-instrumentalists. And I personally, I do a lot of audio engineering. I wouldn't consider myself a producer just because I really just do it so I can get my ideas down and, you know, make sure they're professional sounding and so on and so forth, just so I can hear exactly like, oh, you know, this is what it's going to sound like actually, sort of thing. And it was really nice, yeah, having three people to kind of just bounce ideas off of or bounce ideas back and forth. And it really gave us that perspective of, you know, like if I were a keyboardist, you know, what would I put here? Or, you know, what's really going to fit here? Or, you know, what needs to be the simple or what needs to be the lead and so on. And, you know, actually, I think there's probably only two riffs that we went into the studio with that we were pretty set on using. and that we, you know, kind of had an idea of how we were going to build a song and what we wanted to do with them. sorry, just one sec. My mind kind of just went off on a tangent. But yeah, we only came into the studio with a couple riffs, and kind of what was interesting about that is that we came to the studio with almost nothing on the musical end, you know, other than like, I think the big riff in our music video, I Can See Everything, is, you know, one of those riffs that we were, you know, dead set on using and really had a clear idea of how we wanted to structure the song. Whereas, you know, Undertow was one of those songs. That was the first song we recorded there. And we kind of were just like, let's just delve into it and let's see what happens. And, you know, Nico was like, well, let me come up with something. And it kind of just went from there. And I guess the big point I was trying to bring up is that, you know, the music was kind of, you know, something that didn't really come to life too much until we, you know, got to the studio and really started delving into it. Whereas the lyrics have been around for, I'd been working on those lyrics actually for about 3 or 4 years. And a lot of them are, yeah, just, you know, bits and pieces from, you know, a lot of different stuff that, you know, I've been through, you know, been through throughout life, and just all these experiences kind of not put into one, but, you know, collectively put together. And a lot of the songs are actually about, you know, one specific event, you know, just one thing that happened a few years ago, and kind of how that event has, you know, kind of shifted my life and my view of life, you know, over these years. And, you know, I feel like those lyrics really reflect kind of, you know, not just, I guess, the emotion that I was going through at the time, but a lot of the changes and just struggles that, you know, you kind of deal with when you, I guess, hit a wall, you know. You know, it feels like, you know, kind of that was, you know, the big thing behind Time Froze and You Set the Fire, is that moment where, you know, your emotions and life has just reached this point where it feels like everything has just stopped. And, you know, the world is, nothing's moving, you know, maybe the world's spinning, but you're standing still, sort of thing. And, you know, just how sometimes, like, you know, situations can, you know, kind of leave you in a place or, you know, in a mindset for years and years and years. And, you know, that's pretty much, I guess, what Another Life is about. I think it was really cool being able to take lyrics from, you know, years ago that I'd been wanting to, you know, transform into a song, but, you know, having been a drummer for so long, I just never got around to it.
Well, and so, looking at the lyrics in hindsight a few years later, you know, maybe gives you a different perspective.
Absolutely. And kind of one of the things that happened to me in the studios, you know, it had been many years since, I guess, this event that, you know, sparked all this, all those lyrics or whatever happened. But kind of, you know, when we were in the studio, I was like, you know, we're like, well, let's start writing some lyrics and start coming up with some vocal melodies. I was kind of weary to use them, actually, because it'd been so long. And I was like, I'd wanted to work on them for forever. And here I am, you know, years later being like, I don't know if I should do this because, yeah, you know, I've gained perspective on the whole event and kind of, I guess, where I was at with, you know, that person specifically and just how it transformed over the years.
Now, did you change any of the lyrics when you went and revisited them, or did you add an addendum verse or something to it, to anything? Or?
A couple of lyrics we reworded in areas, just to kind of think of a specific one. And a couple of them we kind of, you know, I probably had, I want to say at least a few pages of lyrics. It's like endless amounts of notes in my phone. You know, just, oh, here's an idea. And I basically took all those, compiled them, and we started, you know, kind of taking bits of pieces of what we thought really fit together and really painted kind of a picture that was, you know, already there. I think one of the songs that we didn't really change the lyrics too much on actually was I Can See Everything. Other than, actually, originally the song started off with the second verse being the first verse, lyrically at least. And that changed. It's actually Cameron's idea. And I really liked it because it really kind of sets up this motion within the song. You know, you've got, I think the first lyric is, we took this hourglass and we shattered it, which is basically, you know, kind of saying, you know, we took our past or we took our time and, you know, we left it all behind us and, you know, we're moving on to be in the present sort of thing. And originally that went off and started with volcanoes erupt, the sky turns black. And then the second verse was that, you know, shatter the hourglass lyric. And I think that really, you know, initially, like when I first wrote it, I wanted to use that idea of, you know, like just to set the basis, like, hey, everything is black, you know, everything is falling apart. You know, the volcanoes are going off and the world is in cataclysm sort of thing. And I think changing that kind of, you know, build it up as, you know, initially everything is fine. And it turns into this story of almost, you know, how people have, I guess, wronged each other and how, what is the word I'm looking for? I guess how, you know, how things essentially come to fruition, I suppose. Really, like, I can see everything. I guess a big thing about that is, you know, like when, you know, just for hypothetical, I guess, like, you know, when someone lies to you and it's like, you know, I know you're lying to me sort of thing, or just being able to really see, like, you know, I think that song really shows that perspective on those years that passed, you know, from that event to actually recording those songs and using those lyrics. Sorry, I'm a brain fart.
Oh, no, that's okay. No, I understand what you're saying, totally. So one thing I've got to ask, though, with the timeline between the lyrics and the music and the finished product, what is your favorite song on Another Life and why? If you could only pick one.
I only get one. Well, you know, that's a tough one. I'd say personally my favorite, I guess I have a favorite and I have one that I guess I'm most close to. I'd say my favorite would have to be I Can See Everything, because that song really displays a lot of raw emotion, while the chorus is this very clean, almost crisp kind of, what is the word? It's almost like, you know, it's not dirty in any way, shape, or form. It's just perfect. And I think, you know, that song really just shows, like, the transition from, like, I guess in my life, from, you know, being this angry kind of, almost, you know, in a way, you know, disturbed by life person, to becoming this, like, almost retrospective or, you know, introspective person who is able to kind of pick up on what's actually going on and, you know, quote, see everything. On another note, though, I'd say the song that I'm closest to would have to be, part of me wants to say Undertow, but the other part of me wants to say Time Froze. And Time Froze is a really personal song for me because it almost transports me back to what happened. And that, you know, that exact moment when everything fell apart, and I can see me standing there. I was in California at the time, and oddly enough, I was, not to, you know, put Taco Bell in the mix, but I was right across from a Taco Bell. That's all I remember about the street. But I'm on the street corner, and I basically, you know, get this, you know, it's almost like that message, like, you know, it's, you know, everything's done, you know, it's over. Leave Me Be sort of thing. And, you know, that song, every time I hear it, it takes me back to that spot. And sitting in California, actually right outside of, it's right by USC, actually, right in LA. And, yeah, it's kind of a surreal thing, you know, being taken back, you know, by a song, and even more specifically by your own song. You know, because obviously, you know, you hear a song from a few years ago and you think about something that you associated with that song, you know, that, you know, all that time ago. Whereas with a, you know, a song that you write, it's kind of different. You know, there, you know, part of you, you know, it depends on how close you are to the event, but part of you is emotional about it, and part of you is kind of standoffish about it. Almost. Yeah.
Now, do you think that that song maybe gives you some closure or some retrospection on that?
I think every time I listen to it, it kind of reminds me. I think the bridge action in the middle is the biggest part that, you know, keeps me going almost, is that it's the lyric. It goes, changes and changes. The past never changes. The future is a mystery. Our presence, our haven. And that was a big thing for me, because for the longest time I was, you know, stuck in the past and, you know, worried about all these things that had already happened, while also, you know, thinking about the future and being like, where am I going? What am I doing? But never really thinking like, what, I don't know, people get lost in, you know, the past and the future and thinking about what happened, what they should be doing rather than just doing.
Yeah, a lot of
being in the present.
A lot of people, myself included, I'm guilty of this as well. We've all at some point in our lives have let the past dictate our future.
Yep.
You know, exactly, 100%. Exactly. And a lot of people don't realize that they have the power within them to break every cycle they're in.
That's absolutely true. You know, I, for the longest time, actually, you know, I struggled with addiction to multitudes of things. It was a terrible time in my life, but just, you know, after dealing with that, you know, it really is, you know, when it comes to breaking the cycle, it's really a battle between you and your own mind.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I've been there myself, man. So I know exactly what you're talking about. Now, and you know, the great part about breaking cycles is it gets easier the more you do it.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's definitely, it's one of those things that, when you're stuck in your way and you got all your habits and stuff, and just, you know, starting the downfall of dominoes is the hardest step.
Yep, exactly. You know, what's funny, like with myself, I had when I was touring a lot in my early 20s, late teens and early 20s, I was 21 for 4 years too when I was first started out playing live, because I was 16. So, yeah. but, you know, when I got married, you know, I stopped the alcohol and all that other stuff too. And a few years ago, I changed my eating habits and I quit smoking. And that wasn't, that was not as hard. I mean, you know, like after quitting all the stuff that I had quit before, it just seemed like, okay, this is something else I need to look out for.
Right. For me, actually quitting drinking was super easy, because I've never been one to really enjoy alcohol, at least when you get past that point, obviously. I kind of did the same thing, actually, a few years ago. You know, I had started working out, I used to be quite the chubby guy, actually. I just back in middle school, so that must have been, gosh, almost 10 years ago, I was like 5 feet tall, and I weighed about 215 pounds. So I was a hefty kid, and up until, like, you know, I grew taller, and obviously I got a little bit skinnier looking, but I didn't actually lose any of the weight until I was 18, and yeah, I started eating healthy and, you know, stopped eating fast food and anything really processed, and quit doing, you know, all the drugs and stuff. And just, I think a big thing for me is diet is probably the hardest thing to change, but it's like has the biggest, yeah, most nominal effect on your body.
Exactly. See, my problem wasn't food so much as, like, I was working so much on all, like, all the Jammer Direct stuff, because I'm the only person developing for it and stuff, because I'm the creator, mm-hmm, and stuff. But I wasn't eating, and then on top of that, I was drinking tons of Mountain Dew, Red Bull, and coffee.
Yep. You know, I was in that same exact thing where I was drinking tons of Coca-Cola. Where right now I can't drink a sip of Coca-Cola. I will puke all over you, sort of thing. But yeah, I used to, it was something, you know, like drinking like 8 to 10 sodas a day, just absurd. And, you know, just so much sugar intake with no carbs and no real nutrition.
Mm-hmm. But also caffeine. You know, mm-hmm. because just like
a nuts amount of it.
Yeah, because with me it was all about staying awake so I can get more stuff done. You know, mm-hmm. But do you think maybe society like contributes to that? Because like, you know, until like in my case, until I started, you know, paying attention, like I would just like, oh, if I hop in the car, drive down to McDonald's, I can be back here in 10 minutes and I'm done eating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think society absolutely contributes to that because, specifically, I mean, no one really learns about how to eat healthy or how to work out right. Like that's not something that you learn in school or anything like that. So just to begin with, you're setting up this establishment for people to have no basis on how to help themselves almost and how to take care of themselves. And actually Nico, you know, he always asks me health questions because he doesn't really know, you know, the proper way to work out or maybe, for instance, like, you know, the fact that you should eat protein immediately after you work out and just little things like that where it's like no one ever learns that. You know, you see people at the gym and like, oh, it's great that you're trying to help yourself. But the fact that I see these people on their phone taking a minute or two in between their reps is just like the most killer thing to me. I'm like, you're doing nothing for yourself right now. You're like doing all this hard work to not really get any benefit from it.
Exactly. Another thing a lot of people don't realize too, that the best way to curb an appetite if you are overweight and you're trying to lose weight is to drink water.
Oh yeah. People, it's crazy to me that people, I mean, you're supposed to drink what, 64 ounces of water a day. And I think people maybe drink a glass at that and just that speeds up your metabolism so much that it, you know, I made a lot of switches. I went from eating, you know, 3 normal meals to now I probably eat like 9 snacks a day or something like that, where it's just like I'm constantly just taking in food. And I don't know, I think people always forget. And I mean, I've been lucky enough. I'm still in college and I'm going for an economics degree, which is kind of nuts. But I've been lucky enough to learn, you know, or I guess to have to take some science classes, and just people don't really realize how water is obviously, you know, the basis for life, and most everything, you know, every process in life tends to happen in water, from, you know, birth to, you know, other things.